Start thinking unity over self. We're in this together. Even if we can't carry the load all the way, we're going to take our crack at picking up the heavy end. We're going to be of service to others. Help ourselves by helping them. Becoming better because of it, drawing purpose from it. Whatever you're going through, whatever is holding you down or standing in your way, can be turned into a source of strength by thinking of people other than yourself. You won't have time to think of your own suffering because there are other people suffering and you're too focused on them. Pride can be broken. Toughness has its limits. But a desire to help? No harshness, no deprivation, no toil should interfere with our empathy towards others. Compassion is always an option. Camaraderie as well. That's a power of the will that can never be taken away, only relinquished. Stop pretending that what you're going through is somehow special or unfair. Whatever trouble you're having, no matter how difficult, is not some unique misfortune picked out especially for you. It just is what it is. This kind of myopia is what convinces us, to our own detriment, that we are the center of the universe, when really there is a world beyond our own personal experience filled with people who have dealt with worse. We are not special or unique simply by virtue of being. We're all, at various points in our lives, the subject of random and often incomprehensible events. Reminding ourselves of this is another way of being a bit more selfless. You can always remember that a decade earlier, a century earlier, a millennia earlier, someone like you stood right where you are and felt very similar things, struggling with the very same thoughts. They had no idea that you would exist, but you know that they did. And a century from now, someone will be in your exact same position once more. Embrace this power, this sense of being part of a larger whole. It is an exhilarating thought. Let it propel you. We are all just humans doing the best we can. We are all just trying to survive, and in the process, inch the world forward a little bit. Help your fellow humans thrive and survive. Contribute your little bit to the universe before it swallows you up, and be happy with that. Lend a hand to others. Be strong for them, and it will make you stronger. Meditate on your mortality. When a man knows he is to be hanged in a fortnight, it concentrates his mind wonderfully. Dr. Johnson. In late 1569, a French nobleman named Michel de Montaigne was given up for dead after being flung from a galloping horse. As his friends carried his limp and bloodied body home, Montaigne watched his life slip away from his physical self. Not traumatically, but almost flimsily, like some dancing spirit on the tip of his lips, only to have it return at the last possible second. This sublime and unusual experience marked the moment Montaigne changed his life. Within a few years, he would be one of the most famous writers in Europe. After his accident, Montaigne went on to write volumes of popular essays, serve 2 terms as mayor, travel internationally as a dignitary, and serve as a confidant of the king. It is a story as old as time. Man nearly dies, he takes stock, and emerges from the experience a completely different and better person. And so it was for Montaigne. Coming so close to death energized him, made him curious. No longer was death something to be afraid of. Looking it in the eyes had been a relief, even inspiring. Death doesn't make life pointless, but rather purposeful. And fortunately, we don't have to nearly die to tap into this energy. In Montaigne's essays, we see proof of the fact that one can meditate on death, be well aware of our own mortality, without being morbid or a downer. In fact, his experience gave him a uniquely playful relationship with his existence, and a sense of clarity and euphoria that he carried with him from that point forward. This is encouraging. It means that embracing the precariousness of our existence can be exhilarating and empowering. Our fear of death is a looming obstacle in our lives. It shapes our decisions, our outlook, and our actions. But for Montaigne, for the rest of his life, he would dwell and meditate on that moment, recreating the near-death moment as best he could. He studied death, discussing it, learning of its place in other cultures. For instance, Montaigne once wrote of an ancient drinking game in which participants took turns holding up a painting of a corpse inside a coffin and toasting to it. "Drink and be merry, for when you're dead, you will look like this," they toasted. As Shakespeare wrote in The Tempest not many years later, as he himself was growing older, "Every third thought shall be my grave." Every culture has their own way of teaching the same lessons. "Memento mori," the Romans would remind themselves. "Remember, you are mortal." It seems weird to think that we'd forget this or need to be reminded of it, but clearly we do. Part of the reason we have so much trouble with acceptance is because our relationship with our own existence is totally messed up. We may not say it, but deep down we act and behave like we're invincible, like we're impervious to the trials and tribulations of mortality. That stuff happens to other people, not to me. I have plenty of time left. We forget how light our grip on life really is. Otherwise, we wouldn't spend so much time obsessing over trivialities, or trying to become famous, make more money than we could ever spend in our lifetime, or make plans far off in the future. All of these are negated by death. All these assumptions presume that death won't affect us, or at least, not when we don't want it to. "The paths of glory," Thomas Gray wrote, "lead but to the grave." It doesn't matter who you are or how many things you have left to be done. Somewhere there is someone who would kill you for $1,000 or for a vial of crack or for getting in their way. A car can hit you in an intersection and drive your teeth back into your skull. That's it. It will all be over. Today, tomorrow, someday soon. It's a cliche question to ask, what would I change about my life if the doctor told me I had cancer? After our answer, we inevitably comfort ourselves with the same insidious lie. "Well, thank God I don't have cancer." But we do. The diagnosis is terminal for all of us. A death sentence has been decreed. Each second, probability is eating away at the chances that we'll be alive tomorrow. Something is coming, and you'll never be able to stop it. Be ready for when that day comes. Remember the Serenity Prayer. If something is in our control, it's worth every ounce of our efforts and energy. Death is not one of those things. It is not in our control how long we will live or what will come and take us from life. But thinking about and being aware of our mortality creates real perspective and urgency. It doesn't need to be depressing because it's invigorating. And since this is true, we ought to make use of it. Instead of denying or worse, fearing our mortality, we can embrace it. Reminding ourselves each day that we will die helps us treat our time as a gift. Someone on a deadline doesn't indulge himself with attempts at the impossible. He doesn't waste time complaining about how he'd like things to be. They figure out what they need to do and do it, fitting in as much as possible before the clock expires. They figure out how, when that moment strikes, to say, "Of course, I would have liked to last a little longer, but I made a lot out of what I was given already, so this works too." There's no question about it. Death is the most universal of our obstacles. It's the one we can do the least about. At the very best, we can hope to delay it, and even then, we'll still succumb eventually. But that is not to say it is not without value to us while we are alive. In the shadow of death, prioritization is easier, as are graciousness and appreciation and principles. Everything falls into its proper place and perspective. Why would you do the wrong thing? Why feel fear? Why let yourself and others down? Life will be over soon enough, death chides us, and we might as well do life right. We can learn to adjust and come to terms with death, this final and most humbling fact of life, and find relief in the understanding that there is nothing else nearly as hard left. And so if even our own mortality can have some benefit, how dare you say that you can't derive value from each and every other kind of obstacle you encounter? Prepare to start again. Live on in your blessings. Your destiny's been won. But ours calls us from one ordeal to the next. Virgil. The great law of nature is that it never stops. There is no end. Just when you think you've successfully navigated one obstacle, another emerges. But that's what keeps life interesting. And as you're starting to see, that's what creates opportunities. Life is a process of breaking through these impediments, a series of fortified lines that we must break through. Each time you'll learn something. Each time you'll develop strength, wisdom, and perspective. Each time a little more of the competition falls away, till all that's left is you, the best version of you. As the Haitian proverb puts it, behind mountains are more mountains. Elysium is a myth. One does not overcome an obstacle to enter the land of no obstacles. On the contrary, the more you accomplish, the more things will stand in your way. There are always more obstacles, bigger challenges. You are always fighting uphill. Get used to it and train accordingly. Knowing that life is a marathon and not a sprint is important. Conserve your energy. Understand that each battle is only one of many, and that you can use it to make the next one easier. More important, you must keep them all in real perspective. Passing one obstacle simply says you are worthy of more. The world seems to keep throwing them at you once it knows you can take it, which is good, because we get better with every attempt. Never rattled, never frantic, always hustling and acting with creativity, never anything but deliberate, never attempting to do the impossible, but everything up to that line. Simply flipping the obstacles that life throws at you by improving in spite of them, because of them, and therefore no longer afraid, but excited, cheerful, and eagerly anticipating the next round. Final thoughts. The obstacle becomes the way. Late in his reign, sick and possibly near death, Marcus Aurelius received surprising news. His old friend and most trusted general, Avidus Cassius, had rebelled in Syria. Having heard that the emperor was vulnerable or possibly dead, the ambitious general had decided to declare himself Caesar and forcibly seize the throne. Marcus should have been angry. History would have forgiven him for wanting to avenge his enemy, to crush this man who had betrayed him, who threatened his life, his family, and his legacy. Instead, Marcus did nothing, going as far as to keep the news secret from his troops, who might have been enraged or provoked on his behalf, but waited to see if Cassius would come to his senses. The man did not. And so Marcus Aurelius called a council of his soldiers and made a rather extraordinary announcement. They would march against Cassius and obtain the great prize of war and a victory. But of course, because it was Marcus, this war prize was something wholly different. They would capture Cassius and endeavor not to kill him, but, as Marcus said, to forgive a man who has wronged one, to remain a friend to one who has transgressed friendship, to continue faithful to one who has broken faith. Marcus had controlled his perceptions. He wasn't angry. He didn't despise his enemy. He would not say an ill word against him. He would not take it personally. Then he acted, rightly and firmly, ordering troops to Rome to calm the panicking crowds, and then set out to do what must be done. Protect the empire, put down a threat. As he told his men, there was one profit they could derive from this awful situation that they had not wanted. It would be to settle this affair well, and to show to all mankind that there is a right way to deal even with civil wars. The obstacle becomes the way. Of course, as so often happens, even the most well-intentioned plans can be interrupted by others. For both Cassius and Marcus, their destiny had been changed when a lone assassin struck Cassius down in Egypt 3 months later. His dream of empire ended right there. Marcus's initial hope to be able to forgive in person his betrayer ended as well. But this itself created a better opportunity, the opportunity to practice forgiveness on a significantly larger scale. The Stoics like to use the metaphor of fire. Writing in his journal, Marcus once reminded himself that when the fire is strong, it soon appropriates to itself the matter which is heaped on it, and consumes it, and rises higher by means of this very material. The unexpected death of his rival, the man who Marcus had been deprived of granting clemency to, was this metaphor embodied. Marcus would now forgive essentially everyone involved. He wouldn't take any of it personally. he'd be a better person, a better leader for it. Arriving in the provinces shortly after the death of Cassius, Marcus refused to put any of the co-conspirators to death. He declined to prosecute any of the senators or governors who had endorsed or expressed support for the uprising, and when other senators insisted on death sentences for their peers associated with the rebellion, he wrote them simply, "I implore you, the Senate, to keep my reign unstained by the blood of any senator. May it never happen." The obstacle becomes the way, forever and ever and ever. Yes, it's unlikely that anyone is going to make an armed run at our throne anytime soon. But people will make pointed remarks. They will cut us off in traffic. Our rivals will steal our business. We will be hurt. Forces will try to hold us back. Bad stuff will happen. We can turn even this to our advantage, always. It is an opportunity, always. And if our only option, as was the case with Marcus, because of someone else's greed or lust for power, is simply to be a good person and practice forgiveness, well, that's still a pretty good option. This, I'm sure you've noticed, is the pattern in every one of the stories in this book. Something stands in someone's way. They stare it down. They aren't intimidated. Leaning into their problems or weakness or issue, they give everything they have mentally and physically. Even though they did not always overcome it in the way that they intended or expected, each individual emerged better, stronger. What stood in the way became the way. What impeded action in some way advanced it. It's inspiring. It's moving. It's an art we need to bring to our own lives. Not everyone looks at obstacles, often the same ones you and I face, and sees a reason to despair. In fact, they see the opposite. They see a problem with a ready solution. They see a chance to test and improve themselves. Nothing stands in their way. Rather, everything guides them on the way. It is so much better to be this way, isn't it? There is a lightness and a flexibility to this approach that seem very different from how we, and most people, choose to live with our disappointments and resentments and frustrations. We can see the bad things that happen in our lives with gratitude and not with regret because we turn them from disaster to real benefit, from defeat to victory. Fate doesn't have to be fatalistic. It can be destiny and freedom just as easily. There is no special school that these individuals attended, aside from, for many, a familiarity with the ancient wisdom of Stoicism. Nothing that they do is out of reach for us. Rather, they have unlocked something that is very much within each and every person. Tested in the crucible of adversity, forged in the furnace of trial, they realize these latent powers, the powers of perception, action, and will. With this triad, they first, see clearly. Next, act correctly. Finally, endure and accept the world as it is. Perceive things as they are, leave no option unexplored, then stand strong and transform whatever cannot be changed. And they all feed into one another. Our actions give us the confidence to ignore and control our perceptions. We prove our will with our actions. The philosopher and writer Nassim Nicholas Taleb defined a Stoic as someone who transforms fear into prudence, pain into transformation, mistakes into initiation, and desire into undertaking. It's a loop that becomes easier over time. To be sure, no one is saying you've got to do it all at once. Margaret Thatcher didn't become known as the Iron Lady until she was 60 years old. There's a saying in Latin that translates to, "We gather strength as we go." That's how it works. That's our motto. In mastering these three disciplines, we have the tools to flip any obstacle upside down. We are worthy of any and every challenge. Of course, it is not simply enough to listen to this or to say it. We must practice these maxims, rolling them over and over in our minds and acting on them until they become muscle memory. So that under pressure and trial we get better, become better people, leaders, and thinkers. Because those trials and pressures will inevitably come. And they won't ever stop coming. But don't worry, you're prepared for this now. This life of obstacles and adversity. You know how to handle them, how to brush aside obstacles and even benefit from them. You understand the process. You are schooled in the art of managing your perceptions and impressions. Like Rockefeller, you're cool under pressure, immune to insults and abuse. You see the opportunity in the darkest of places. You are able to direct your actions with energy and persistence. Like Demosthenes, you assume responsibility for yourself, teaching yourself, compensating for disadvantages, and pursuing your rightful calling and place in the world. You are iron-spined and possess a great and powerful will. Like Lincoln, you realize that life is a trial. It will not be easy, but you are prepared to give it everything you have regardless, ready to endure, persevere, and inspire others. The names of countless other practitioners escape us, but they dealt with the same problems and obstacles. This philosophy helped them navigate those successfully. They quietly overcame what life threw at them, and in fact thrived because of it. They were nothing special, nothing that we are not just as capable of being. What they did was simple. Simple, not easy. But let's say it once again just to remind ourselves. See things for what they are, do what we can, endure and bear what we must. What blocked your path now is a path. What once impeded action advances action. The obstacle is the way. Postscript. You are now a philosopher. Congratulations. To be a philosopher is not merely to have subtle thoughts, nor even to found a school. It is to solve some of the problems of life, not only theoretically, but practically. Henry David Thoreau. You now join the ranks of Marcus Aurelius, Cato, Seneca, Thomas Jefferson, James Stockdale, Epictetus, Theodore Roosevelt, George Washington, and many others. All these men explicitly practiced and studied Stoicism. We know this for a fact. They were not academics, but men of action. Marcus Aurelius was the emperor of the most powerful empire in the history of the world. Cato, the moral example for many philosophers, never wrote a word down, but defended the Roman Republic with Stoic bravery until his defiant death. Even Epictetus, the lecturer, had no cushy tenure. He was a former slave. Frederick the Great was said to ride with the works of the Stoics in his saddlebags, because they could, in his words, sustain you in misfortune. Montaigne, the politician and essayist, had a line from Epictetus carved into the beam above the study in which he spent most of his time. George Washington was introduced to Stoicism by his neighbors at age 17. Then he put on a play about Cato to inspire his men in that dark winter at Valley Forge. When Thomas Jefferson died, he had a copy of Seneca on his nightstand. The economist Adam Smith's theories on the interconnectedness of the world, capitalism, were significantly influenced by the Stoicism he'd studied as a schoolboy, under a teacher who translated the works of Marcus Aurelius. Eugène Delacroix, the renowned French Romantic artist, best known for his painting Liberty Leading the People, was an ardent Stoic, referring to it as his consoling religion. Toussaint L'Ouverture, himself a former slave who challenged an emperor, read and was deeply influenced by the works of Epictetus. The political thinker John Stuart Mill wrote of Marcus Aurelius and Stoicism in his famous treatise On Liberty, calling it the highest ethical product of the ancient mind. The writer Ambrose Bierce, decorated Civil War veteran and contemporary of Mark Twain and H.L. Mencken, used to recommend Seneca, Marcus Aurelius, and Epictetus to aspiring writers who wrote to him, saying they'd teach them how to be a worthy guest at the table of the gods. Theodore Roosevelt, after his presidency, spent 8 months exploring, and nearly dying in, the unknown jungles of the Amazon, and of the 8 books that he brought on the journey, 2 were Marcus Aurelius's Meditations and Epictetus's Enchiridion. Beatrice Webb, the English social reformer who invented the concept of collective bargaining, recalled Marcus's Meditations fondly in her memoirs as a manual of devotion. The Percys, the famous Southern political, writing, and planting dynasty, Leroy Percy, United States Senator, William Alexander Percy, Lanterns on the Levee, and Walker Percy, the moviegoer, who saved thousands of lives during the flood of 1927, were well-known adherents to the works of the Stoics because, as one of them wrote, when all is lost, it stands fast. In 1908, the banker, industrialist, and senator, Robert Hale Ives Goddard, donated an equestrian statue of Marcus Aurelius to Brown University. 80 or so years later, after Goddard's donation, the Soviet poet, dissident, and political prisoner, Joseph Brodsky, wrote in his famous essay on the original version of that same statue of Marcus Aurelius, but in Rome, that if meditations is antiquity, it is we who are the ruins. Like Brodsky, James Stockdale spent time imprisoned against his will, 7.5 years in a Viet Cong prison camp, to be exact. And as he parachuted from his plane, Stockdale said to himself, I'm leaving the world of technology and entering the world of Epictetus. Today, Bill Clinton rereads Marcus Aurelius every single year. Wen Jiabo, the Prime Minister of China, claims that Meditations is one of two books he travels with and has read it more than 100 times over the course of his life. Best-selling author and investor Tim Ferriss refers to Stoicism as his operating system, and in the tradition of those that came before him, has successfully driven its adoption throughout the Silicon Valley. You might not see yourself as a philosopher, but then again, neither did most of these men and women. By every definition that counts, however, they were. And now you are too. You are a person of action, and the thread of Stoicism runs through your life just as it did through theirs, just as it has for all of history, sometimes explicitly, sometimes not. The essence of philosophy is action, in making good on the ability to turn the obstacle upside down with our minds. Understanding our problems for what's within them, and their greater context, to see things philosophically and act accordingly. As I tried to say in this audiobook, countless others have embodied the best practices of Stoicism and philosophy without even knowing it. These individuals weren't writers or lecturers, they were doers, like you. Over the centuries, though, this kind of wisdom has been taken from us, co-opted and deliberately obscured by selfish, sheltered academics. They deprived us of philosophy's true use, as an operating system for the difficulties and hardships of life. Philosophy was never what happened in the classroom. It was a set of lessons from the battlefield of life. The Latin translation for the title of Enchiridion, Epictetus's famous work, means close at hand, or as some have said, in your hands. That's what the philosophy was meant for, to be in your hands, to be an extension of you, not something you read about once and put on a shelf. It was meant, as Marcus once wrote, to make us boxers instead of fencers. To wield our weaponry, we simply need to close our fists. Hopefully in some small way, this audiobook has translated those lessons and armed you with them. Now you are a philosopher and a person of action. And that is not a contradiction.
This is Tim Ferriss, producer of this audiobook and friend of Ryan Holiday's. What follows is a bonus chapter or bonus interview, a conversation between Ryan and myself where we explore the origins of the book, his background, many of the situations that he has tackled personally using the tools of Stoicism and everything you've read about or heard in The Obstacle is the Way, and much, much more. I hope you enjoy it. So Ryan, to start off, I suppose we could talk about our mutual love of Stoicism and how we both fell into the throes of philosophy. But
yeah,
for many people, I think they number one, don't know perhaps the origins of how you encountered Stoicism. I remember one of your friends, one of our mutual friends, telling me about how you were one of the odd ducks out who was fascinated by Stoicism in high school. I think that is part of the story, but maybe you could give us a little bit of background on how you ended up encountering all these various characters historically and getting into it.
Yeah, it was weird. It actually wasn't high school. I was in college. I was writing for a newspaper, and I got sent to this conference that Dr. Drew Pinsky, you know, he has a show on HLN. He's the host of Loveline. He was like leading this private session with college journalists about, and I sit through the whole thing, and then after I walk up to him, and I don't know what possessed me to do this, but I asked him if he had any books that he would recommend, because he seemed like a very smart person who read a lot. And he was like, you know, I'm reading this book about this philosopher named Epictetus. And it's a philosophy known as Stoicism. I think it's really good, and you should check it out. And so I went, and I bought it on Amazon. I still have, like, the Amazon receipt, so this would have been, like, 2006. So I bought it, and then I bought this other book called The Meditation of Marcus Aurelius, which Amazon like suggested, you know, when they link purchases. This was before Amazon Prime. So Marcus Aurelius comes first, and I sit down and I read it, and it just, you know, totally blows my mind in the way that like a book can blow the mind of a 19-year-old boy, I guess. Tyler Cowen calls them like quake books, like books that sort of shake everything. And it was that for me. It was like this book that totally turned my whole life upside down. And at the time I just got dumped by this girl that I dated for a super long time. And I was, you know, like deciding whether I wanted to do this college thing or not. And it was just this book that was like, it was the perfect book at the perfect moment. And it's philosophy, yes, but as you know, it's philosophy that you can actually read that helps you with actual problems that you're dealing with. And so it was the perfect thing. And I got introduced to it by the guy who does calls about STDs on the radio at like from midnight to 2 a.m., which is not what I would have expected, but you know, the rest is history.
Yeah, it's funny. I actually had no idea, which is hilarious given how much we've talked about this type of thing before, that was how you were introduced to all of this. So Dr. Drew also deals with, is very involved with a number of nonprofits that deal with, say, heroin addiction, and mm-hmm. and I can imagine why he would pick that book up. As a side note, what year of college was this, if you remember? And secondly, not the year itself, but were you yeah. freshman, sophomore, et cetera? Secondly, how old was Marcus when he was penning this notebook, I suppose, that became Meditations? And then lastly, what type of decisions did you make as a result of reading the book?
Yeah, sure. So I was just starting my sophomore year of college, and I ended up dropping out at the end of that year. And I think we met, if I remember correctly, like a few months later. And you quote Seneca in the 4-Hour Workweek, and I think that was one of the things that we connected by.
Yeah.
So it sort of all was happening at the same time. But Marcus Aurelius, he wrote Meditations, as far as I understand, while he was emperor. So he would have been in his 30s and 40s. He died fairly young. Like, we don't know how long he was writing the book. Like, there's a few places that allow historians to date it somewhat. But we don't know, like, what each specific meditation was referring to or why. We just know that he was writing them usually at night during what would only be a very stressful job that you would have to decompress about every day. And so for me, I like, you know, when you go through a breakup, you are usually you're angry, but then you're also sort of not self-loathing, but you feel crappy and worthless and you don't know what to do. And so for me, it was this idea of like, look, get off your ass. You can make the best of this situation. Like, what are you going to do about it? So one of the things that I did when I read this book was it sort of sent me down this path of other things to read. Like he says in the book, he says like sort of go directly to the seat of knowledge, in terms of like how to learn. Mm-hmm. And so, he actually says like throw away your books, go directly to the seat of knowledge. So I sort of did both. I went and I read every book that I could about philosophy, about life, biographies, and that set me, you know, I've read hundreds and hundreds of books since then. But I also snagged these mentors that showed me like real life, and they taught me things in person. And I think that's when I learned that this idea of philosophy and like a life of doing things and being successful and working were not at all mutually opposed. I think a lot of people find philosophy and it just sends them down this rabbit hole of books and they get further and further removed from reality as a result. And so right. that this did not have that effect for me.
And
How would you, I feel like philosophy, we talked about this when I originally proofed early, I guess, drafts of The Obstacle is the Way, your latest book, that, you know, philosophy, selling philosophy is problematic, right?
Sure.
Because I think the term for most people, it conjures an image of the schmuck in Good Will Hunting in the bar.
Sure.
Who's paraphrasing literature without giving any credit, or some like tortured graduate student at NYU who loves to sort of quibble over semantics of words that really at the end of the day, the argumentation is just a lot of fancy tail chasing. And that's, I think, a very mainstream interpretation of this word philosophy. How do you view philosophy? How do you present it to people so that it's palatable or attractive?
Yeah. So when I sat down to write the book, I totally empathize with that. No one wakes up and says like, hey, like I need philosophy. They say, you know, I have this problem and I need a solution to this problem. Well, it turns out that historically that's what philosophy actually was for. Specifically Stoicism. Like there's a great quote from Henry David Thoreau where he says like, you know, to be a philosopher is not about like having subtle thoughts or founding a school. It's about solving the problems of life, not theoretically, but practically. And I think the Stoics understood that much earlier, you know, like 2,000 years ago. Cato, who you've written about, was considered to be a philosopher, but not because he wrote anything down, but because of how he lived his life. You know, Socrates didn't write anything down. Epictetus, we only have his lessons because a student of his wrote them down as notes. Mm-hmm. And Marcus Aurelius is like, he wanted to be a philosopher, but he was in line for the throne. And so he had to mix his philosophy with being the most powerful man in the world. Mm-hmm. And so what I think is really interesting about Stoicism, and I talk about this in the book, is when you look at it and you see that it has this, it tends to have a resurgence when times are really, really bad. So like, Stoicism was very popular during the American Revolution. Like George Washington read the Stoics as a teenager. At Valley Forge, he actually put on a play about Cato, which is one of the most popular plays in the world at that time. Thomas Jefferson died with a copy of Seneca on his nightstand. And then during the Civil War and in the Victorian era, you saw another resurgence of Stoicism. Stoicism was big during the American Revolution, the Industrial Revolution, the Enlightenment, the Renaissance. And then, you know, it was also like Marcus Aurelius was living in the decline and the fall of the Roman Empire. Like it doesn't get much worse than that. And so it's basically at its core, it's this philosophy that says like you don't control the world around you. You only control your response to that world. And so that's a very practical and beneficial philosophy when a lot of things are happening around you that you wish weren't happening.
Mm-hmm. No, that makes perfect sense. I can't recall how I was first introduced to Seneca specifically. I had read at some point or been forced to read, I'm sure, some excerpt of, say, Epictetus or Meditations, probably in college, and as with most things you're forced to do, most likely did not find a lot of joy in it. But Seneca really grabbed me, and I don't want to go into a long story of why that's the case, but so you have this, let's just call it the trifecta of Stoicism, or the big three, right? You have Epictetus, Marcus Aurelius, Seneca. It seems like Marcus is primarily your guy. I don't know, but I've been very curious to see how different people resonate with different Stoic thinkers. And I'm curious, number one, who your primary influence is. And secondly, why you think that is and how you think different people are attracted to different Stoic thinkers.
Sure. Well, it's interesting too about philosophy. Like most people are never forced to read the Stoics because professors don't like them as much because there's not as much room for interpretation. Like it's pretty straightforward. And right. I think that's why you like Seneca. I like him as well. It's like he says these sort of very timeless, eminently practical truths in a straightforward, clear way. And they talk about it in the context of like our actual problems. Like they talk about, hey, like, you know, Seneca will be writing a letter. It's like, hey, like, you know, I heard like your wife died. Like, here's some advice.
Yeah. I hear you're getting slandered in the Senate, or there's a lawsuit pending.
Yeah.
Here are my thoughts. Yeah.
Totally. Totally. So I like you, I lean towards Seneca, but also Marcus Aurelius, because they were two, like, Seneca was one of the most financially successful men in Rome. He was an advisor to Nero. He was a sort of famous tutor and playwright, but he was also skilled at investment. So he was very financially successful. So when you read his stuff, he's dealing with the sort of the same timeless problems that anyone who has success or works in business deals with, you know, bad markets, luxury, you know, he's just sort of dealing with all the temptations of business he's talking about. So I like him a lot as well. Personally, I like Marcus Aurelius. I like the notion, like, what's so fascinating to me about him is he was literally the most powerful man on earth. Like, he was worshipped as a god in his own lifetime. He could do whatever he wanted. And you read this book that he wrote primarily for himself, and it's just notes about self-discipline, about being a good person, about, like, forgiveness, about, you know, honor, about treating people well. That's where I like it. I get the most practical benefit in terms of, like, leadership and self-awareness and stuff like that. So that's why I like Marcus Aurelius. Although I will say, I think it's funny, like, you read this book and at the beginning, Marcus Aurelius is, like, sort of thanking all the people who, like, gave him lessons. And, like, one of the lessons he learned was, like, not raping his slaves. So it's like, it's sort of pretty, it's on the one hand, it's very relatable. Like, he congratulates himself for never having laid a hand on his slaves. So you can sort of take it gives you a pretty clear idea of what he's alluding to there. But you realize, like, it's very relatable, but then also very foreign at the same time.
Right.
But, like, what other person in that position do we have a document about their thoughts? Like, when you could literally do anything you wanted without repercussion, here's a guy writing notes to himself about being a good person, not taking advantage of everything that he could take advantage of, like, forgiving people and all this stuff, which I take a lot of personal value out of. And I think his writing is so clear and straightforward, and it's written in this sort of it's written in these epigrams that are easy to remember.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's Epictetus is great too. He's a little more lectury, and because he was a teacher, you're getting the lectures.
Gets into the cosmos a bit too, and in some pretty esoteric ways that aren't immediate. They're more abstracted, I think, more professor friendly for interpretation.
He's the most religious of the philosophers, of the Stoics as well, which, personally, not being a religious person, doesn't have the same amount of relevance for me. Like, when you read Marcus Aurelius, he's not talking about, like, Zeus and stuff, which, you know, I think makes it feel a little bit more relatable. And it's definitely the same is true with Seneca. Like, if you'd never heard of Seneca and someone took his works and translated them and took out all the anachronisms, you could very easily fool someone into thinking this was written, like, in the last decade.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. No, that's... That for me, was critical, and the way that I try to define philosophy for people who have never read philosophy or who have been put off by philosophy, as they perceive it, is, you know, this is an operating system for making better decisions in your life. That's it.
Mm-hmm.
And I found it so incredibly powerful. You mentioned something, just a moment ago about Seneca being one of the wealthiest people in Rome, if not the wealthiest at one point. I mean, extremely shrewd investor, investment banker, financier. And let's talk about Stoicism for a second, because the word Stoic or Stoicism has developed modern connotations that I think perhaps turn people off of the concept of studying something or reading something called Stoicism. And, I remember a quote, I don't remember the attribution, which was, you know, most people face life with the same stoicism as a cow standing in the rain. And I think that people, a very common perception of stoicism, and perhaps this is true for some people, I mean, Cato seems the most kind of Spock-like in a lot of ways, is that you feel neither pain nor joy. You are just basically a cyborg. And the goal is to not experience emotions whatsoever.
Right.
And, also I think people perceive it as asceticism or foregoing right. all of your worldly possessions. And of course, Seneca was very highly criticized and continues to be highly criticized as, the opulent Stoic. Like, how can he talk about foregoing riches or, and I'm kind of laying this one up because I've obviously read right. a lot about this, but I'd love for you to talk about how you would reconcile some of those things. Like, does Stoicism, is it compatible with material or financial success or being famous, or are they completely at odds with one another?
Sure. Well, look, I think since both of us are authors, we can very relate to the problem that's happened with the Stoics over the last 2,000 years, which is it's a bunch of people psychoanalyzing people they've never met based on their work. And, right. and over the generations, it builds on itself. And the problem is what they're forgetting is that the Stoics it's a philosophy that's designed to solve certain problems and specifically only those problems. So, you know, Marcus Aurelius isn't writing notes to himself at night that says like, hey, like women are really pretty, don't forget, or like, hey, you should laugh and have a good time, or like, you know, money is nice. No one needs like a reminder of certain things, right?
Right.
And specifically, since he was not writing a book for other people, he was writing a book for himself. I think you can safely assume that he's writing reminders to himself about the things that he's particularly bad at, right? And so it's a deliberately selected view of a person who's struggling with tough things in their life. He's not, again, trying to explain a systemic worldview that you should keep in mind. He's working through problems in his own personal way. And maybe if Seneca had had different friends that were really somber and sad all the time, he would have written them different letters. Like Cicero was a Stoic, or studied Stoicism, and there's more joy in his writings, maybe just because it was a totally different situation. So what I want people to keep in mind is that Stoicism is not about being sad or not having emotions. It's about keeping an even keel and not getting upset or delusionally happy either. And so I actually think there's a core tenet of optimism in Stoicism. Like,
yeah.
I called the book The Obstacle is the Way, and it's based on this exercise from Marcus Aurelius where he's saying, like, look, it doesn't matter if you're trying to do something and you get blocked. This is actually an opportunity to practice virtue. So basically what he's saying is like, hey, I know this thing that happened that you think is bad. It's actually good, and it's actually a chance for you to do good things. To me, that's like, that's cheerful, and that's happy, and that's the kind of attitude of someone who never gets depressed because
right.
they always feel like they have a way out.
Right.
And what the Stoics were saying is, like, if you go around thinking that the world is great and that it's always going to work out exactly how you plan and that people are always going to treat you well, like in one of the things, Marcus reminds himself that tomorrow when he wakes up, people are going to be rude, they're going to cheat, they're going to steal, they're going to argue with you, they're going to do all these things. He's doing that so he can go out and interact with them in a positive way rather than feeling let down and pissed off all the time.
Right.
So I think that's super important, and I think that's something that's totally been missed from Stoicism, and I think that's why you and I are attracted to it and find value from it in our lives. It's not like confirmation of our pessimism or cynicism, and on the contrary, I actually feel like it's intimately connected with being happy and fulfilled as a person. And that's why I don't think it was a contradiction at all that Seneca was successful and seemed to genuinely enjoy his life and had financial riches. I think Nicholas Taleb is another person. The point is, making money is usually a result of being successful or good at something. It can also be a result of luck or fortune. And having it doesn't say anything good about you, and it doesn't say anything bad about you either. And the only problem that really comes from wealth, well, there's a couple problems, but being financially successful, and I'm not a millionaire, but I'm doing well, there's temptation to, you know, spend money on negative things, let's say. But the real problem is thinking that you need this money to survive. And so it's funny, like, Seneca has this reputation for being opulent, but in Letters to a Stoic, he talks about actually practicing poverty, like one day a month, pretending that all his money was stolen or lost and that he's walking the streets as a homeless person. He's doing that so he can enjoy his wealth while he has it, but never feel like it's integral to his survival or existence as a person either.
Right. No, it's been, I think, you know, not to bring Fight Club into this, but you know, the things we own end up owning us. And I think there's a big difference. And this might actually be a Thoreau quote, who had his own contradictions like we all do.
Yeah.
I heard he used to sneak off and have big meals at Emerson's house while he was at the, at Walden. But, and that is that, you know, the problem is not having riches, it's when riches have you. And
totally.
I think Seneca comments on that quite extensively. And, you know, the problem is not having wealth, it's when it becomes a source of sort of fear and greed, and it dictates how you behave, as opposed to being a tool. Therein lies the problem. Besides, obviously, these fantastic, works of literature, or I suppose that might not even be a fantastic label. I mean, in some cases, they're war journals of sorts.
Right.
Coming back to seeking out mentorship in real life, teachers in real life, was Robert Greene really the first person to take you under his wing in that way? Or was there someone else who was sort of a pivotal teacher to you?
Sure.
And how did that come to be?
Yeah. So actually before I met Robert, I was working with Tucker Max, who we both know.
Right. And Robert, of course, just to give some context, maybe you could explain, give some context on both of them.
Yeah. So Robert Greene wrote The 48 Laws of Power, The Art of Seduction, and The 33 Strategies of War. And then I met him in, you know, 2006, 2007. I was in college. I met him through Tucker Max, who's another number one New York Times bestselling author, sort of known as a really good sort of internet marketer and thinker, and then also does crazy things. Tucker showed me about marketing. He introduced me to Robert. Robert really showed me about writing and researching and learning. And I worked with Robert on his last two books. He wrote one called The 50th Law, which is about fearlessness with the rapper 50 Cent. And then he wrote one called Mastery, which is about, you know, becoming a master at whatever it is that you do.
Yeah, great book.
Yeah, I love it. It was like an honor to be a part of it. So those were my two mentors in like sort of direct mentorships. But I also think like, you know,
how did you how did you, just in the sort of the details, the nuts and bolts, how did you initially connect with Tucker Max?
It all goes back to this college newspaper. I was writing, I had a column there, and I decided I would use it as an excuse to write articles about people I wanted to meet. And so I wrote a review about Tucker's website and I emailed it to him, and we just started this relationship, and then I would just email him and ask questions. So it's funny, I think you probably see this, like people think mentorships are these like very official relationships, like the way that an apprenticeship was like your parents basically sold you to someone in exchange for like room and board for a certain number of years, and then you officially learn a trade. Like a mentor is anyone who you learn from, who gives you advice and teaches you things, and you don't actually have to meet them for them to be your mentor. Seneca talks about this. I forget who he's talking about, but he says like, you know, find yourself someone that you can use as like a benchmark or a ruler to compare yourself to, so you can decide when you have, you know, difficult choices, like what would this person do in this situation? How would they act? What should I do here? And so like, I would even say you are definitely one of those people. Like we don't have some official mentor mentee relationship, but like you've taught me so much, and I've asked you questions, and hopefully like, you know, it's gone both ways, but like you're older than me, you're more successful than me, you've taught me things, and that's what I think a mentorship is. And you can have that with basically anyone. I think a lot of people, they hold out for this like sanctioned official relationship rather than just like learning from anyone who has wisdom or advice or value that they could pass your way. And if you put it into practice and you do something with it, they see value in that as well.
Yeah, no, I agree, and I appreciate the kind words, obviously.
You were the one who, like, I was studying Stoicism. It was interesting to me, and I think I mentioned it to you, And then you encouraged me to write an article about it for your site, which sort of set me down this whole path to begin with. And so I think, you know, it's weird how these little conversations can have such a big impact on your life. But it just depends on, I think, you know, how people respond to and treat the opportunities that they get that often don't look like opportunities when they, you know, sort of first make their appearance.
Oh, definitely. I mean, Jack Canfield, who co-created Chicken Soup for the Soul, is largely responsible for the 4-hour work week becoming a book. And It was just one or two offhand comments that he made to me that were encouraging in the early days that produced the proposal, because it coincided with a bit of downtime. And he effectively helped force my hand by making introductions that led to conversations with agents. And it's incredible how, in the case of Jack, you know, he became a mentor to me because, very similar to the newspaper, I used volunteering for tech nonprofits as a way to meet the people I wanted to meet. These events would put on these organizations like the Silicon Valley Association of Startup Entrepreneurs. It's a mouthful, but SVACE, or TIE, the Indus Entrepreneur, put on large events every few weeks or every quarter. They'll have an event where they bring in thought leaders and their panels and so on. And so I volunteered for SVACE when I first moved to Silicon Valley in 2000, and really just kicked ass as a volunteer for a few months and continually took on more and more and more responsibility until I was invited to sit in on the board meetings, just as an observer, basically. And they were talking about their next main event, I think is what they called it. And I just kind of raised my – they're like, well, who are we going to get to do this and manage the event and wrangle the speakers? And I just kind of shyly put up my hand. And I was like, I'll do it. I'll take care of it. And so they handed it over, and I put together a panel. God, what was it called? It was called something like, you know, Titans of Consumer Products or something. And I invited, you know, the creator of the clapper and the pet rock. I invited the guy, Ed Bird, who is sort of the jointly responsible for popularizing creatine in the United States as an athletic supplement, which was a huge, huge deal. The founder of Cliff Bar, Jack Canfield, and so on and so forth, and got to know Jack by inviting him to this event and having a bunch of emails back and forth. And then over the years, you know, asked him every once in a while, pretty rarely, would ask him very specific, short kind of life questions. That's how the whole thing came to be. So in the case of Tucker, for instance, how long after you initially introduced him to the article you wrote, did you start asking questions? Over what period of time, you know, how frequently did you email him? I think this is something people need to understand, because asking someone to be a formal mentor is like the absolute best way to never have a good mentor.
Totally.
Because it's like, hey, you want to sign up for a unpaid part-time job because you have so much free time? It doesn't work. So I'd just be curious to hear sort of what you did and what you would recommend people do if they're trying to find or looking for that type of teacher. I think mentor is problematic because they think of it in such formal terms. But maybe you could talk on that point.
Yeah, totally. I think it was once every couple weeks a couple months probably. And I would just ask like questions that I thought would be helpful to me, but very easy for him to answer.
Right.
And that's what, you know, it's like, hey, if you want me to read your manuscript, that's like a lot of work for me to do.
Yeah.
Or this would be more for you. If someone wants you to read their manuscript, you're like, okay, that's like a week of my time. Yeah. If someone wants you to give a 5-second instant opinion on a title, you're like, sure, that's one email.
Right.
And so I think people don't think, one, they don't think about, you know, what they're actually asking. And then two, they ask a lot over and over again. When really, it's actually interesting. There's this thing called the Ben Franklin effect. I don't know if you know this story, but.
About the lending library or the.
Yeah.
Why don't you tell the story? This is such a great story.
So Benjamin Franklin, there was this member in Congress, or one of the things about the American Revolution, or I don't really remember where it is actually, but Benjamin Franklin faced this sort of enemy in a legislative body who he desperately needed his support, and they seemed to be intractably opposed to each other. And what Benjamin Franklin did was he heard that this guy loved rare books and had a prized library of rare books, one book that he valued above all the others. So Ben Franklin, being a somewhat bold man, walks right up to this guy and just asks him if he can borrow his most prized possession. And the guy, sort of stunned, is like, I guess. Benjamin Franklin borrows it, just puts it on his shelf for like 2 weeks, doesn't touch it, doesn't use it, and then returns the book to the guy. And what he finds is that